where is God? And you might give the answer, well, God's in heaven. Or maybe you say, well, God's in my life. He's in my heart. Or yeah, and maybe you're really thinking, you know, God lives where the rich and famous people live, or he's where the brokenhearted are. Maybe you say, well, he's at the bottom of the ocean, or God's on the moon, or he's in a distant galaxy. And the answer, the correct answer, according to Psalm 139, is yes, he is in all of those places, and God is here. We're in Psalm 139 this morning. If you're using one of the seat Bibles, that's page 521. We're in a short series in the Psalm, and each week we're looking at a characteristic or an attribute of God. And this week we're at this well-known Psalm of David, 139, about one of the characteristics of God. He's always near. He's always here. Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is it light with you, for you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I could count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if they're be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is the word of the Lord. So Psalm 139 is about what we call God's omnipresence. That means God, not just a remote God. He's not a distant God. He's here. He's present everywhere. He's everywhere that I am. He's unlike anyone else in the universe. He's always wherever he needs to be to do whatever he needs to do, whatever needs to be done. That's omnipresence. And omnipresence is kind of a difficult concept for us to grasp. That's the main thing that David shows us here in Psalm 139. God is here. There's three things in Psalm 139 that David shows us about God, the presence of God. God is present everywhere. God's presence challenges me, and God's presence transforms my life. First, God is present everywhere. So Psalm 139, like all of the Psalms, it's a song. And as a song, it's broken up into stanzas, or what we call verses. And the first three verses, 1 to 6, 7 to 12 and 13 to 18 shows us how God surrounds us, how he's present with us, how he surrounds us. God's knowledge surrounds us. That's the first verse, verses 1 through 6. David the poet shows us how God knows us wherever we are, whether I'm sitting, whether I'm sleeping, if I'm home, if I'm traveling, if I'm gone on vacation, a business trip. He knows all about me. He knows me inside. He knows me outside. We tend to just see the outside. We look at the external. But God knows my thoughts even before I think them. Wrap your brain around that. He knows what you're going to think 5 minutes from now, and you don't. God knows where we've been. He knows where we're heading. And you and I, because we're limited to time and space and we're human beings, we only see a small slice of the whole. God sees all of it. We're surrounded by his knowledge. God's presence surrounds us. Not only does his knowledge surround us, but his presence surrounds us. And that's that second verse, verses 7 to 12, second stanza. God is everywhere. He's at all times, all places. He's actively present in every situation at every time. Whatever you're going through, wherever you are, God is there. Psalm 46, verse 1, he is our ever-present help in trouble. Isaiah 57, God says, I live in a high and holy place, but also with the one who is contrite and lowly in spirit. So that tells us that God is both immanent, he's near us, and transcendent, high and holy and different than us. Try to figure this out. He's everywhere. Psalm 33, verse 13. From heaven, the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place, he watches over all who live on earth. And so, although God is present in time, in all time and space, God is not locally limited to time and space like we are. We are 21st century people existing in 2019. And that really is the only thing we can see right now is October 20th, 2019 at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And we can't see any different than that. But God sees all of it. God is everywhere and in everything now. There is no molecule, no atom, no particle so small that God's not fully present in it. No galaxy so vast that God does not surround it. He is unlimited in respect to time and space. Jeremiah 23, 23. Do I not fill heaven and earth? So David here explains that it not just part of God that's in every place. It's not like you have your part of God and you have another part of God. All of God is everyone. It's not like there's one part of God here and another part of God over there on that distant galaxy somewhere. It's God himself. All of it, present everywhere. God is present in every part of space with his whole being, and yet he acts differently in different parts, different places. So we have to be very careful when we tread here. And when we're talking about omnipresence, we have to, because many, many people and many, many, many religions confuse and completely understand and misunderstand the nature of God. And one of the most popular religions in the world today and in America in 2019 is pantheism. Pantheism says that God is in everything, that God is the trees, and God is nature, but there is no personal God. God is nature. He is a life force, and matter is just an illusion. It's all God. Everything you see and touch, and every one of us, it's all God. God is everywhere, but he's not a personal God. So when we talk about Mother Nature and who's control of the weather, who's going to send, well, Mother Nature might send us a storm on Thursday, and so we're talking about pantheism. Everything is God. That's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that God is present everywhere in his creation, but he is distinct from his creation. He is not the creation. We must not worship what he has made. And this is a very, very important distinction. This isn't just a tidbit or a trivia of theology. This is huge. And you are being brainwashed to believe pantheism. You are. James Duthot wrote recently in the New York Times. You remember the movie Avatar, those blue, weird men and people and space kind of thing? Avatar is Cameron's long apologia for pantheism, a faith that equates God with nature and calls humanity into religious communion with the natural world, the trees and Mother Nature. Pantheism has been Hollywood's religion of choice for a generation now. It's the truth that Kevin Costner discovered when he went dancing with wolves. It's the metaphysic woven through Disney cartoons like The Lion King and Pocahontas, and it's the dogma of George Lucas's Jedi, whose mystical force surrounds us and penetrates us and binds the galaxy together. Do you realize that they are pushing a radically different religion and a totally different kind of God than what the Bible describes? God is not the force of Star Wars. He is the creator, and he is the controller of all of it. His presence is everywhere. And there's that word in verse 7, that word presence. Where can I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? And the Hebrew word presence means face. Face, God's face. He's saying everywhere I go, there's God's face. His presence. He's completely present at every point of time and space. And this is absolutely amazing. So God's knowledge surrounds us and his presence surrounds us. Third, God's power surrounds us. God's power surrounds us. And that's that third stanza, verses 13 to 18. We're surrounded by his power. And David says here that you, both your body and your soul, were created by God and upheld by God. Verse 16 in the New Living Translation. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. So, Parker, new baby born yesterday, Parker, God knows every breath, every heartbeat, every event, every moment of his life, all of it already. Isn't that incredible? All your days are ordained. In Acts 17, the Apostle Paul quotes the Greek poets, in him we live and move and have our being. And he's saying that from conception to last breath, God is in charge. He made you. He ordained you. He sustains you. He upholds you. His power controls every second of your life. So you're figuring out what David is saying here? At one end of human life is conception. He says, in my mother's womb you knew me, you were knitting me together. What about the other end of life? At the very tail end, when you're old and when you feel like, what in the world am I here for? And why am I getting old? And why am I falling apart? And I wish I had died earlier. And at the very end of your life, it's ordained. It's ordained. Every second of every day that you live on earth is ordained. There's a plan. There's a reason. Whether your life is 99 days or 99 years, God planned it all. The ethical implications of this are huge. Just huge. The implications of God's presence with us in every moment of every day. And this is the reason that everybody over the centuries who have taken this doctrine of God seriously, from the early Christians, the ancient Jews, the Christians through the centuries, they have always said that both abortion and active euthanasia are wrong. Taking a life at the beginning of life, taking a life at the end of life, it's wrong. Why? Because you're putting yourself in the place of God. You're replacing God with yourself. And instead of letting God be in control of the length of life, you are determining that yourself. God is in charge of both of those parts of life, the beginning of life and the end of life. And it's not our place to do that. Life at the very, very beginning in the womb, and life at the very, very end when you're old, it's fragile. It's inconvenient. I think I know of what I talk. I've spent hours and hours and hours in the hospital this week with my dad and been caring for him along with other family members. And it's hard. It's hard. We might say, well, let's do something about it. But that's a violation, according to the Bible, of the glory and rights and privilege and ownership of God. Now, you think, oh, Mike's getting into politics here. This has nothing to do with politics. It has nothing to do with politics. This is a biblical issue. It's about the doctrine of God. All your days are ordained. You're still under the shadow of God and His presence and power, and God's presence is an inescapable fact of every aspect and dimension of life. God's present everywhere. Second thing that David tells us, God's presence challenges me. God's presence challenges me. What becomes clear as you read Psalm 139 is that David is not some theologian living in an ivory tower who's writing a boring summary of God's attributes. Okay, let's sign up for a class on the attributes of God, and I'm going to read this text in a monotone, and you're going to be asleep within 30 seconds, I guarantee, right? And when we think about the attributes of God, that's sometimes where we go, is that, oh my, this is going to be really hard, and there's going to have words there that I can't understand. But this is not David. This theology radically affects his heart. He tells us how he feels about the truth of God. It blows my mind, what he says in verse 6. This knowledge is too wonderful for me. This is just too much. I can't handle this. I can't get this. I'm reeling at this. So why is that? Why is this theology so mind-blowing? Verse 5, he says, this is suffocating me. I'm like I'm living under a blanket. I find all of this somewhat threatening, and I want to run away. You know, this the implications of what I'm learning, this is so big that I just want to try to escape. And so he says in verse 7, where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? Same words exactly. Same words in the Hebrew that Jonah used when he ran away from God. You remember Jonah? God told Jonah to go and preach the word of the Lord to the Ninevites. And Jonah feared and hated the Ninevites. So he said the same words, get me out of here. And that's what David's struggling with, this idea of a God who is all-knowing, all-present, all-powerful. This is almost like a complete nightmare to him. It blows my mind, and it's inescapable, the presence of God. It's this inescapable fact. Where shall I flee from your presence? And that's why so many people deny that God even exists. A lot of people. Many people, your friends, your family members, your coworkers, they try to explain God away. They try to find other reasons for our existence. Because if this is true, if there is an all-powerful God who made you and sustains you, then He has claim on your life. And He can tell you what to do. And we resist that. We want to be free. And this is exactly how we destroy ourselves. We run from God. We run from the one who owns us and sustains us and keeps us going. And what David is claiming here is that there is a God who completely creates and surrounds and controls and sustains everything, all of it. So what there is no room for here in Psalm 139, there is no room for a friendly man upstairs or a God who we make in our own image, or a small God, a God who sits in heaven and puts evolution on auto start and lets things just kind of run while He stands up there as observer. He's just watching it happen. No, not here. This is a God who is intimately involved in every microscopic detail of the universe and of your life. So, here is your logical, reasonable, spiritual option. Either there is a big God who surrounds everything, or there's no God at all. Don't take the stupid option of saying, well, there's a small God, and he's not really in control, and, you know, he's just somebody I can consult when I'm having questions or trouble or I need a little help. That God doesn't exist. Don't even try that small God option, because it's not viable to you. If you reject this big God, Psalm 139, you're left with nothing, and that'll drive you nuts. It's insanity. If there is no big God, then there's no you. You're just a random collection of atoms, and death is the end. If there's no big God, then you have no free will, because all you're doing is what your genes tell you to do. It's a godless universe, and every decision you've made, it's just an illusion. And you might think that you're making the decision about who you're going to marry, or whether you're going to quit smoking, or if you're going to move to Michigan or move to California. But remember that if there is no God, you're not really making those decisions. It's just biology working through some chemicals in your brain. Remember, if there is no big God, then there is no you of which to speak. Your biology made you do your thing, and your mind tricked you into thinking it was voluntary. If there is no God, there is no value to your life. You have no lasting significance. There is no right or wrong. There is no ultimate justice. Who's to say that Hitler was wrong? Who's to say that evil is real? Who's to say that murder and rape are wrong? Well, if there is no big God, there is no ultimate justice. There's no such thing as evil and injustice. If there's no God, then something came from nothing. So work this out. Work this out. Why is there something rather than nothing? And that question has occupied philosophers for centuries. It's a really tough question. Where did all this stuff come from? Where did the universe come from? Where did your house and car and kids, and has it always been around? Well, one thing's for certain. This created universe is incredibly complex, and scientists have for centuries pointed out the absolute impossibility of the complexities of life forming out of mute, unguided chance, chaos. So David says here, I've worked this thing out. Here's what David, 3,000 years ago, he figured this out. I've worked this thing out, and the God of the Bible, the one who created the universe, is an immeasurably big God. He's present everywhere. And he says, that is impossibly hard for me to wrap my brain around. God's presence challenges me. Number three, God's presence transforms my life. God's presence transforms my life. David eventually, in this psalm, breaks out of his confusion and his sense of being threatened. And he begins to see God's presence as an overwhelming joy. So he's first contemplating this theology of omnipresence, and it's like, wow, I don't know how to deal with this. But then it becomes this incredible blessing to him. It changes his life. And it's right there in verse 11 and 12. I'm going to read it in New Living Translation. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness, I cannot hide from you. To you, the night shines as bright as day. Darkness and light are the same to you. What is darkness, Bible students? What is darkness in the Old Testament, in the Psalms, in the Bible? What is darkness? What's it associated with? Darkness is suffering, danger, possible death, pain, disease, terror. That's darkness. And so when you're walking through darkness and you're walking through suffering and hardship and really tough days, there's a sense in which I'm lost. And David says, you see through all of it. You see through all of it. Three implications. Number one, God will never lose you, even in the darkest night. Verse 18, I awake and I'm still with you. God can't lose me, even in the darkness. Verse 17, you know everything. Your thoughts are precious. Your thoughts are like fine jewels. I'm with you at all times. And David is saying, I'm moving away from this idea of being threatened by the presence of God to being comforted by it. God has me by the hand and he will never let me go. Verse 10, Even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. One translation says, he will hold me fast. And that's where that song comes from. He will hold me fast. He's got me. To you, the night shines bright as day. Maybe you can't see the road ahead. And you're dealing with terminal illness. You're dealing with incredible financial hardships. And maybe you've gone through a miscarriage and it feels like life is never going to be back on an even keel again. You can't see the way ahead. You can't. You're having trouble even seeing right in front of you. But to God, it's like high noon on a sunny day. He sees all of it. And David is saying, he's going to be with me through death. He's going to wake me up. He's going to wake me up. And even though I go through the most difficult of things, he's going to wake me up. And when I wake up in my resurrected body, I'm going to see him. I'm going to be there with him. And even though you go through darkness, and even though you go through the darkness of death, you will be resurrected. Nancy Guthrie lost two children. She knows what suffering's all about. She knows what it is to be a parent who has lost a child, an incredibly hard thing. And a friend, a church friend, came to her and just didn't know what else to say in her mourning and said to Nancy, death sucks. And Nancy said she was just a little taken back that she would use that kind of a language. But you know, she's absolutely right. It's the truth. It's our final enemy, and Jesus has conquered it. You go through the night, through the darkness, through that pain and suffering, and I wake up, and you're there. You're there. There's this place in Mark chapter 5 where Jesus is brought to the room of a little girl who has died. Can you imagine losing your little girl who's just learning to play some instruments and taking up sewing and laughing and playing and growing into a young woman, and then she's gone. She's laying there dead, and you can just imagine the emotions that her parents feel. She's in deep darkness. And so Jesus tells her dad, tells her friends, don't weep. Now, is that not just like the worst thing that you could ever say at a funeral home? Go to somebody who's just lost their child and say, don't weep. He takes her by the hand. He says, Talitha kum, Talitha kum. Talitha, little one, kum, get up, get up. That's the same expression that you would say to your three-year-old when you go in when nap time's over and say, hey, sweetie, time to get up. Nap time's over. Jesus sits down by this little girl. He says, honey, it's time to get up. And he reaches right through death, right through the darkness, and he grabs her by the hand, and he defeats the ultimate enemy of the human race. When I awake, then I am still with you. I'm surrounded by you. There is nowhere that I can go. Nowhere that I can go that you aren't there. I'm surrounded by you. He is a big God, and he knows all about you, and he loves you, and he will never lose you, even in the darkest night. Second implication. When you struggle with the presence of evil, return to see the nature of God in your own brokenness. So we have these very, very strange verses. In fact, verse 19 to 22, they're so odd that a lot of people have said they really don't belong in this psalm. Somehow they just, you know, accidentally dropped in there. The psalmist made a they put in the song book together, and it's crazy because people can't understand what these verses are doing here. When I look at the world around me, and the presence of God is not always obvious because people are evil. Nations act in evil ways. People hate God, and people hate one another. How do I explain the presence of evil in this world? So you have these verses, 19, 20, 21, 22, and they're very strange to our ears, and they sound like they don't fit. They're really weird to our minds. Okay, here's your life verse. Ready? I hate them with complete hatred. What you gonna do with that? Make that your verse for the day, huh? So how do I reconcile these verses with, say, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5? You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Whoa. I guess David needed to sit at Jesus' feet for a little while, didn't he? The New Testament says we're never allowed to talk like David talks here in Psalm 139. We're supposed to do good to those who abuse us and hurt us. We're supposed to pray for them. So what happened between David's time and our own time that the Bible says we are to never talk like this? We are not to take 19, 20, 21, and 22, and make those our guide for how to deal with offers interpersonal conflict. Please don't. Don't do that. You're not only going to get fired, you're not going to be on good terms spiritually with God. So what happened here? David's greater son died on a cross praying for his enemies. He lost the presence of God. So I don't have to. And that really is the answer to the riddles here. That's how David has the assurance that he's going to come into God's presence. He's not going to be destroyed, although he probably doesn't understand fully why this is true. That's the reason we are not to say the things that David said, because his son died praying for his enemies. Jesus died praying Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Now, you think about that verse. My God, why have you forsaken me? The omnipresent God became limited to time and space, to a human body, and died. And when Jesus Christ came to earth, he not only gave up his omnipresence, but he lost the presence of God when God forsook him. He can't find the presence of God. Why have you forsaken me? He can't find the God near him. He can't see the face of God. He's in darkness, and God is not there. Why? David had God by the hand, even though darkness turned to light. Jesus Christ knew that he had let go of God's hand, and midday light turned to darkness, didn't it, on the cross. Didn't the daylight turn to darkness? David was knit together in his mother's womb. Jesus Christ was torn apart on the cross. David longs for ultimate justice against his enemy. Jesus Christ bore ultimate justice for David's sins and for mine. Why? Why did Jesus lose the presence of God? Why did the Father let go of his hand? Because he was getting what you deserve. He was getting what you deserve. He was getting what I deserve. We want our own way. We want to escape God's control. We want to do what we want without God's interference. And what's the penalty? The penalty for that is for God to let us have what we want. God lets you go. Jesus Christ was abandoned. And when you believe in your heart in Jesus' death on the cross, you get God's presence forever. He's got you by the hand, and he will never, ever let you go. And once you understand that, once you grasp the gospel, God's presence becomes a comforting, a challenging reality for you. He's always there. He's always there for me. He will never let me go. And when I fail, he knows. When I sin, he's there. When I'm all alone, he's there. You say, well, you know, everything's gone right or wrong lately. Well, maybe it hasn't. Maybe that's him trying to get you to come back to you. He's to him. He's pursuing you. He's not abandoning you. And I can tell you something. The worst times in my life personally, when I thought he was abandoning me, and I can look back on them years later and say, no, he was pursuing me. He was after me. Number three, you can't fix yourself. God alone can reveal what is broken with your heart and heal you. An awful lot of people come to church on Sunday mornings trying to find a way to fix themselves, trying to find out what they need to do to correct what's wrong with their heart. You can't do it. You cannot fix yourself. In light of what David has learned about God's surrounding presence, here's how he prays. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Search me, bring my heart into your light, and test me all over. Look it all over. Test me. Do a spiritual examination. Compare verse 1. So verse 23, search me, O God, know my heart, try me and know my thoughts. Look at verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. Look for any grievous way. And this is a really fascinating expression, grievous way. That's not a term I would use at the water cooler. What does David mean? Grievous way. It simply means, is there anything in my heart that I worship more than you? Lord, would you please reveal my heart idols to me? Would you show me what I love more than you, what I'm putting on the seat of my life rather than you? Self-destructive things that I love more than God. Spurgeon looked at this verse and he says, David wants to see through all his disguises. I want to know my own heart. I want you to reveal my heart to me, Lord. My heart is so complex, I need you to do a spiritual MRI. And really, think about it. Look at these two verses. It's almost like I spent the whole day Friday at the emergency room with my dad. And it's almost like somebody's having a heart attack. And you know the symptoms and chest pain and, you know, call 911, get to the hospital. And at the hospital, they come in to do triage and they call a cardiologist. And the cardiologist comes in. Yes, what can I do for you? Well, I've got chest pain. Well, yeah. A lot of people hurt. What? No, I need you to do a thorough checkup on me. I want you to run all the tests. I want you to hook me up to all these things and put me in the machines and test me out. I want you to find out if there's anything. Lead me in the way everlasting. I want you to get me on the road to a healthy life, Lord. I want you to fix what's wrong with me. Make me healthy again. I have no fear in coming into your presence, broken and sinful though I am, because your son died for me and you are the healing God and I need you to make me right again. In Jesus Christ, he will never let you go. He has you by the hand, and even death is going to be like a night's sleep. All of your darknesses are going to turn to light. There's no refuge from him. There's only refuge in him. Think about that. Where is God? Where is God? He's here. He's here. He's always been here. In his power, and in his knowledge, and in his presence, and the person of his Spirit and his Son. The question is, will you trust this big God? Will you let go of the reins of your life and give them to this big God and rest in him? Let's stand together. Father, we come to you knowing that you are great and worthy and deserve all of our praise. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts and see if there be any heart idols that I haven't recognized and I haven't addressed. Is there anything that I love more than you? Lead me in the way everlasting. Make me healthy. Give me eternal life in your presence. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.